Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. I don't have a lot of news of what I've been doing recently. I've just been at home and working and things like that. But I just do want to give a bit of a warning to people. In the coming few months, the podcast might dry up completely for a while and then suddenly catch up again. I'm not quite sure how to put this, but I'm going to Africa, East Africa for 5 weeks, down to South Africa as well. Going to, was it Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Zanzibar, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and South Africa, all those different countries, 5 weeks, which means I'm probably not going to have very good internet access for around about 5 weeks. I will be reading in that time, listening to audiobooks and things as we're traveling around, but I probably won't have time to do podcasts and probably not the internet access to upload them. So if there is a gap in the feed here for a few weeks, please don't worry too much about it. The podcast will come back in April. So after that very short public service announcements, let's get on to reviewing today's book. In fact, let's pause for a bit before that, because this is going to be a bit of a strange episode, because I'm going to be reviewing a book called Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang, and this is a short story collection. And a few people weren't quite sure if I was going to be reviewing this or not, because I mentioned it on Goodreads, reading this book, gave it a rating and things like that on there, and people say, hey, are you going to do a podcast episode about this? Are you going to do this? A few different people asked me about it by email as well, yes, I will do it, because it's a... normally, I wouldn't review short stories or single short stories or, you know, short story collections by, like, anthologies or published collections from different authors, separate authors. But if there is a collection of stories by one author in a book, it is a book, it is science fiction, and I'll review it. It is a book to review on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast by a single author. And I think that's probably the best way to go about it. I was talking to Eric and Jesse about this when we recorded a recent SFF audio podcast. And I actually pointed out, wait a second, let me just bring up some notes here. I made a note. So I have actually reviewed some other short story collections here on the podcast before on, well, it's not so much a short story collection, but two different short novellas by Alistair Reynolds, Diamond Dogs, Turquoise Days. I did that in episode 5. And then Spider Robinson had a series of short stories called Callahan's Secret, which I thought was a novel, but it's actually a collection of a few short stories all set in the in Callahan's, I think it's Cross Time Saloon, some bar, and the different characters. And there's quite a few of these different short story collections that he wrote. Charles Stross, Accelerando, when I read it, I didn't realize I was starting a collection of short stories, and those are short stories that have been put together. I think 9 short stories that have been put together into a fix-up novel kind of thing, although they are still very much a series of short stories, some of them which I really liked, some of them which I really didn't like, but overall I found it very unsatisfying as a collection of works. And then episode 90, Mike Resnick, Kieran Yaga, is sold as a novel, but it's actually a collection of his short stories all set on a kind of utopian new planet, which is a bit like, Kenya, or mountains in Kenya, or, you know, the Maasai? I can't remember what tribe it is. It's not the Maasai, it's a different tribe. But anyway, the same characters who come back into it again and again, set in the same world. And this is the kind of short story collection that I actually really like. There's you know, these a collection of stories which, like, either a fix-up, but which is still kind of separate stories. One thing that you can come back to here is like the iRobot collection by Isaac Asimov. They are individually written short stories, but then put into some kind of framing story. That's one way to go with short story collections written by the same author. Another kind of thing is, like I say, is like Alistair Reynolds, The Diamond Dogs, Turquoise Days, and here's another one of his called Galactic North. I have that short story collection up beside my bed. I haven't started reading it yet, but that is that's an interesting way of doing it too, because it's set in a universe which already exists. It's like the Revelation Space universe, And there's like Second Chance at Eden by Peter Hamilton, which is all the short stories of his set in one of his the Federation space or whatever it is that he has there, or a certain world, kind of setup. And he's done another one recently. I can't remember what it was called, but again, a collection of short stories set in a wider world. So I really enjoy reading these short story collections, all set in the same world. But this is the first short story collection that I've been reviewing here, which is kind of set in lots of different places, lots of different characters. There's no thread that binds these short stories together, except that they were all written by the same author, which I just want to talk a little bit more about here. Now, short stories. Generally, I find short stories quite unsatisfying. And the reason for that is many things, you know, let me put it this way. I break my reviews of novels down into different sections. As you know, if you've listened to this podcast more than a few times, I always start off and I start talking about the world and the setting that it's in, and then I move on to the plot and the story, the storytelling, and then I move on to like the characters and the relationships between the characters and what I find interesting there. And then because it's a science fiction book, I'll always talk about like the science and the technology and the new ideas that those bring into it. Or if it's fantasy, maybe talking about the magic and the different things there. And then I'll talk about the writing and the writing style and narration if it's an audiobook. And finally, I talk about what themes, like the thematic exploration that the author is doing within her story. And a good novel, if you're going to write a good novel, you've got to excel at all of those things. If you check out the top rated books, if you go to sfbrp.com and click on the episode list link, you're taken to a page and it shows all the books there in order as sorted by rating, my star rating. So you see the 5-star books. Those 5-star books do everything. They have a great setting, a great plot, really interesting characters, interesting science and technology and science fictional ideas, very good writing, and of course, thematically, they really touch me in a way. You know, those stories which make me cry, those stories which make me feel sick, those stories which impact me in an emotional way, visceral emotional way. Plus, they have those other sort of like 4 or 5 different elements in a novel. Those are the things that really, really get to me about novels. Now, short stories don't have time or space to focus on all of those aspects. And if a short story does focus on all of those aspects, it really can grab me on the same way, on the same level as a novel can. Even a short story can grab you on the same level as a very long novel. So it's one of those things. If these things are included, that's what satisfies me. Short stories generally just miss out quite a few of them. Like, so you'll get a story which is just sort of like a setting, and it just explores a setting, or is it just a new technology, and they just talk about a new technology. But good short stories can cut out those things and not have plots, or not have characters, or not have anything interesting with the writing, or not have any thematic exploration, or all these different things that you really want, and they can just sort of like use shortcuts to fill in those missing pieces. For example, let's just go down the list here. We've got like the setting. So as I mentioned before, in Revelation Space, or the Foundation, or the Robot Story, well, not so much the Robot Stories, but maybe like The Culture by Ian M. Banks, you can have, what was the short story collection of The Culture by Ian M. Banks? I can't remember. I can picture the cover of it. It's got a fly on the cover. I can't remember. Anyway, but you get these stories, and he doesn't have to, or these authors, they don't have to go, well, okay, here is all the rules of the universe. This is these characters. These are this kind of character. This is this kind of alien. This is what the rules of faster than light travel is and all that kind of stuff. They don't have to establish the universe, because if you read any single one of their novels, you'll be able to get that. And if you read the short story first without reading any of the novels first, it doesn't matter so much, because the world is worked out enough that it feels it feels like it has substance. It feels like it has weight. It feels like it has some kind of history there. And this short story, which is set in it, suddenly has the feeling as though it's been set in a world. So that's one way to do a shortcut. Or you can set the action in a familiar time period, but not just a familiar time period like today, because today is too familiar. There's very few shortcuts. But if you have like a historical setting, or even like a generic future setting, which is sort of like, oh yeah, aliens have invaded. They destroyed the world, and now this. And if you just open up your book with that, That's great. Another way to do it is, of course, with I remember Isaac Asimov's Nightfall. If you read that, it's a short story, and he just goes, look, I'm going to talk about people, but they're not really people, they're aliens. And I'm going to talk about cars, but they're not really cars, they're just, you know, what you would think of as a car. And he's, and we're going to talk about houses, but they're not houses as we imagine them, they're like alien houses, which I'm not, don't have time to describe. And we're going to talk about like a telephone, but it's not really a telephone, it's what these aliens used to communicate. And he just says that, and then just has a story which is just people talking in a room, but somehow the setting works and the technology works. I guess that works with technology as well. You know, yeah. And back to Asimov. Start off your Asimov's short stories with the three laws of robotics. You don't need to do anything more. You can just go, robots, positronic brains, these three laws, let's go. And you don't need to worry about any other technology. He just gets out of the way in like five lines or five sentences at the beginning of a story. And then he can just get straight onto the plot and the characters and the mystery and the solution to a problem there. That's another way to do it. Characters, you can do the same thing, like we're saying, just have an existing character, like I said, with the Callahan's Cross Time Saloon short story collections, and also with iRobot, you do get recurring characters in there. What is it? Is it Susan something? I can't remember. Calvin? Susan Calvin? I think she's the robot psychologist, and you get these other characters who come back in throughout. There's a bit of a frame story. A frame story is another way to do it, of course. But Accelerando has this short story, and it's the same family that's being involved in all of them. So you can just have these short cuts to the characters, and maybe the overall collection of stories in a short story collection can have the character arc, the character progression that they want. But like I say, just reoccurring characters is often all you need. Asimov had lots of them in his short stories. Heinlein did as well. Even though the ones in Heinlein might have had different names, but it was pretty much the same character that he would just say, oh, and there was this professor, and you're like, okay, I know that guy. What else here? Oh yeah, and the plot. You can actually just miss out the plot from a short story, but still have one, but have a shortcut to it. So you just use like a fairy tale or a well-known, you know, idea or well-known plot idea, which is so well-known that you don't even need to flesh it out, and you just go, okay, this is going to be an alien invasion story. The aliens are going to come down, and then the humans are going to find the way to. They're going to find that secret weapon or that Achilles heel of the aliens, and then they're going to use that to get rid of them. And you can just go, this is the plot. You ready? Everyone knows this plot. Let's go. And this is my variation with these different characters. Or you could just have like, hey, this is my Romeo and Juliet plot. Or this is my whatever plot. There's all these different plots that you don't really have to worry about. You can just sort of like outline it. You sort of set this course at the beginning of the book, or the beginning of the, not the book, the beginning of the short story, and by the end of it, you've just got a variation. And what else here? Writing. So the writing style, normally in a short story, like descriptions are kept to a minimum, and often like conversations are just reported. It's like they had a conversation about this, and next this happened, but so you're not having a conversation which is like a full written account of the full exchange. He said this, and then he said this, and hello, what are you doing today? I'm doing this. Wow, good to meet you. Like that. You just miss all of that stuff and just get straight onto it. But in another way, some short stories are nothing but dialogue, where you just get like two characters in a room talking about a problem. Again, Asimov, bring it back to Nightfall. It's just people in a room waiting for the sun to go dark, or waiting for the sky to go dark. Will it go dark? Will it not go dark? Well, meanwhile, we'll have this conversation, and we'll discuss all the different themes and the different ideas and what could happen, what could do this, like that. And it's just a conversation. So sometimes there is no dialogue, and sometimes it's all dialogue. Just like people sitting in a room working out the problems to the robots or something like that. And finally, themes. The thematic kind of stuff is one of the trickiest ones, that elements of a short story for me, because I like for the themes of a novel to come from the results of a change. And this is what science fiction does so well, is that you set up the rules of the universe, and then you change one of the rules, and then how that plays out with the different characters, and how that plays out in society, and how that plays out in technology and all those different things, lets me see what the author is wanting to talk about. I'm being very reductive, of course, but that is important, because in a short story, often you'll set up, what will happen is the author will set up the world and set up the characters, maybe, but set up the world, and then there'll be a twist, and then it stops. And the twist, and then he goes, think about what could happen next. Now, if it just says, now think about what could happen next, I hate that in a short story, because I don't want just a punchline or a twist or a reveal or a revelation. I like, you know, it's a cookbook, which is a cliche, but that could be like the first chapter or a prologue in a novel. Okay, we get this setup of the world, suddenly this can happen, but then we get this major revelation. Now, how does that play out? In a novel, that can come halfway through. Normally, it comes at around about quarter of the way through. There's a great story, a great example of this by, called Ian by Greg Bear. And it sets up and an asteroid arrives and people go in and they start exploring this asteroid and it's hollow and the different chambers. And then there's a twist. And the first time I read that twist, I think I've read that novel twice now, but the first time I read it, I was like, holy shit, how can the inside be, and if you've read the book, you understand that twist. Now, I think that twist was probably one of the strongest parts of the novel. And then what plays out after that is Greg Bear trying to do his thing and trying to make it interesting. But the twist was good. But if it just finished with that twist, you'd just be like, holy fuck, where is the second book in this series? What happens next? And that's the kind of frustration which gets to me so often at the end of a short story. The idea, the theme in the short story is too big to fit into the space of the story. So the author leaves it out. He says, hey, guess what, guys? I'm going to talk about this idea. Let's go. Actually, no, I'm not. I'll just leave you to think about it. And you're like, what the fuck? Well, just give me the... Oh, no, you don't have space, or you don't have time, or you don't feel like writing a full novel, or you don't think you can do this idea justice. So that's the crux of my problem with short story. If the idea is too big, I'm not satisfied with it being in a short story. But then if the idea isn't big enough, which often happens with short stories, why did you even write a short story? Why did you have to give me shit characters and no setting and all this other stuff which you've just left out because you don't have time to put it in? So you don't have time to actually talk about it, and then the idea isn't even big enough to bring across that. So why didn't you just write it in an article? Or why didn't you just say, hey, I've got a good idea here? Just presenting an idea can be good enough. That's fine. And sometimes short stories seem to hide a weak idea, or they have a too big idea trying to get out of them, and then I want to know what the author thinks. I don't want just an author to tell me what to think. I can think enough. If you just tell me an idea, I'll think about it and come up with 1,000 different stories or 100 different stories or, you know, dozens of different ideas I can take this. Also, I'm not saying that all short stories should be made into novels. If there's a question at the end, there's a lot of short stories which are perfect length. They have a perfect amount of theme in them. The idea is big enough and is covered in a short story, but it isn't big enough to sustain a novel, or might not be big enough to sustain a novel, or the author themselves can be good enough to writing a short story to contain the entire theme within the short story as I wanted to. For example, bring it back to Nightfall by Asimov. Extended into a novel by Robert Silverberg, and very, very disappointing, mainly because all of those things that make a short story good, like I say, it just some dialogue, or you can use to make a short story good, just having dialogue, having a shortcut to the setting, a shortcut to the technology, all these different shortcuts, and just concentrate on the idea, suddenly Robert Silverberg was like, oh, now I'm going to extend it out. But he extended out to a novel, didn't add any other ideas. In fact, denigrated the ideas which were in the short story and just made the whole thing shit. So there's the thing. Anyway, armed with that knowledge of how I think about short stories and what I often find so frustrating about short stories, let me begin... Oh, actually, let me just say this before I begin. Short stories... I'm not saying that all novels are better than all short stories. I'm just saying that if an author isn't very good at one of these elements, for example, setting or writing or characters or anything, there's like this fallback. You can fall back onto these other elements of thematic stuff, of character, of setting, of plot, of technology, of ideas and things. Just look at the review or listen to the review or the last episode that I did by Arctic Rising from Tobias S. Burkell. Like, terrible writing, but thankfully he could make up for it with these other things. So often with short stories, you can have terrible writing, but there's not enough else there to make up for it. There's not enough else there to bring me round to enjoy the actual what I did get, you know. So, like I say, let's begin my review, knowing all of that, of Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang. It was released in, let me check out the beginning, the first page of this book. Should have looked this up beforehand. It was released in, it doesn't really matter, 2002. It's a collection of stories that he wrote from 91 all the way through to about 2001, so over a course of about 10 years or something like that. And yeah, so lots of short stories, so it doesn't really matter when it was published, this book. So the book itself is, what, like 270-something pages long, and it's got eight short stories, or seven short stories, plus a little like fictional article kind of thing, plus some notes, some story notes at the end. It starts off with the Tower of Babylon. Tower of Babylon. This short story is around about, let me just calculate this, around about 30 pages long, let's say. And this has a, let me just break these down by the normal ways I do. Single setting, it's got a single idea, and the setting and the idea, I can just sum up, what if the ancient view of the world, like in ancient Babylon, the view of the world, of the and of the heavens, was correct? So the earth is the center, the sun's up there, the moon is a little bit higher than, or the, what is it, the moon is a bit lower than the sun, then there's the sun, and then there's stars, and can you build a tower to reach heaven? Well, maybe you could, and so people do, and they do. And we know about this, because right at the beginning it says, well, you know, there was this tower that was so long that it takes 4 months to walk to the top of the tower. That's a big tower. To climb the steps, 4 months to reach the top is a big tower. So that's like the idea and the setting. And mostly it is a book about that setting. That's what it's about. It's like, how do we, what would it be like to climb up through the solar system, up, well, not even the solar system, I didn't even think of that. What would it be like to climb up to heaven on the Tower of Babylon if the people in Babylon thought the Tower of Babylon could actually be built to the top? It takes hundreds of years to build this tower, of course, because they're using clay and mortar and bricks and wood and things to get to the top. And the story follows the our viewpoint character is a miner. Not like a young child, but someone who digs holes in the ground. They're reaching heaven and the vault of heaven, and he has to cut a hole up into heaven. That's the idea of the of this short story. So we got the setter, but then again we get to the plot. What is the plot? Actually, I've just told you, there is a plot. People are going up a tower. That is the plot. And then they start digging into the vault of heaven. What will they find? Now, I came up with three possible answers just off the top of my head as I was reading it. And one of the answers that I came up with was correct. So I'm like, oh, that's clever. I'm not saying it's clever because I thought of it. I'm just thinking, is this just a clever ending? But then the story stops and I'm just left with, oh. So characters, we do have one or two or three named characters, but they're not really characters. There's no progression or anything. They're just someone that we can see the world through. We can just follow. They're just a viewpoint character. They climb the tower, we climb with them, they start digging a hole, we see them digging a hole. That's all we really get. What else? There is some technology. We do learn about what would be needed to build a tower, which takes 4 months to reach the top of and reaches all the way up to heaven. Really interesting stuff. So that's sort of brought in there. So let me get onto the themes. And as I said before, we got the consequences. Where are the consequences? And it made me think that here in this book, we don't really have any consequences. We get the book, like Eon, in Greg's Bear Eon. We get up to the point where we discover the secret to this big artifact, which is there, hanging in space and taking a long time and there. And it's there. And then we go, well, how is this going to affect people? How is it going to affect our character? How is it going to affect, you know, how is this discovery going to affect society? The problem is with Tower of Babel is that we don't know. And it's impossible to know because we don't really spend any time with the people in the story. I mean, there's a little bit. We do spend some time when there's people living on this tower. It's so big that people are like born and whole generations of people are born on this tower and live and then die and never touch the ground. Okay, so there's people on the tower, but we don't really know anything about the wider world. So once we find out what is in the vault of heaven, what then? We don't have anyone to, identify with, to worry about, to wonder how their lives will have changed when we find out what we find out is in the vault of heaven. Even though it's really interesting when we get there, and the answer is really interesting there, I'm just like, well, what do we think about now? The possibilities are so wide, and we're not giving any guidance to our thoughts. So it's just like, hey, imagine someone goes up to heaven, and like builds a tower to heaven, and then digs into the vault of heaven, and they find something. What happens? And you're just like, well, I don't know. Anything really could be. Like, so I loved reading the story. I thought the last page was really cool. The reveal was cool. But I'm just like, there's a mismatch between what the impact of this discovery would be on, which is the people and society, and what the story has been about up until that point, which has been about the physical setting, the technology, and the astronomy, and the setting, but not the people. but it will impact the people, but we don't know anything about the people. A bit of a disconnect here with this story. Otherwise, quite a good story. Okay, stories number 2, 3, and 4. Unfortunately, were my least favorite stories. I can't even say which one was my least favorite. I think I liked all of these stories equally as little as each other's, which is very disappointing considering I enjoyed the first story quite a bit. And then 3 stories in a row, really, really disappointing. They have quite a few things in common, which probably will let me explain what I don't like about some short stories. So, second story is about 40 pages long. It's called Understand. And starting off with the setting. There is no setting. It's people in rooms. Plot. And the plot is, or the idea is, what happens if someone becomes really intelligent? Otherwise, there's people in rooms working out the answer to a problem by sitting and thinking about it and maybe writing stuff down or maybe working at a computer. But generally, someone sitting in a room trying to come up with the answer to a problem is the plot, is the story. That's what you get. The character, we do have a character, but it's first person and we don't really know anything about him. And then as soon as he starts, the plot really is like, as I said, what happens if someone becomes intelligent? But as soon as he becomes too intelligent for us to connect with emotionally, it's difficult to understand what he's saying, it's difficult to understand what's going on, and I think it's intentionally difficult, intentionally distancing, which I guess is good writing, but it's not very satisfying when the thing that the person is trying to discover is too big for our minds. It's literally only possible to discover and to think about if you're as intelligent as the person in the book, and nobody is intelligent as the person in the book, except the person in the book, or the people in the book, who are being injected with this intelligence serum. The technology in the book is pretty much just buzzwords about computers and medicine, which is great sometimes, but here, like, if that's all you're relying on, it's not so much. And then the main idea in the story is it possible for a mind to know itself fully? And in the end, we get the answer to that question, and then it just stops. And then I think, well, what do I think about now? And I really didn't think about anything after this novel, but this might be a personal thing, just as a guide to why I don't really find this very interesting is because I've just finished writing a novel called Broken Glass, and it's a working title anyway, and that's the third novel in a series of 3 novels called Minding Tomorrow. And one of the main questions in this series and this novel, especially the Broken Glass, is it possible for a mind to know itself fully? And considering, like, the main resolution to all the action in all 3 novels, which all 3 novels have been building up towards, revolves around me kind of answering this question, or using this question as an interesting plot resolution over, like, and this is a story that I've had in my head for maybe 6 or 7 years. A 40-page short story on the same topic didn't really give me a lot to ponder. And the stuff that I want to ponder and the things that I would like to talk about with this kind of thing about a mind that could know itself fully takes me 3 novels to write about. Maybe it's because I'm not a good enough writer and Ted Chiang is a much better writer than me, but I just don't think this problem is very well suited to a short story, especially if that our access to a mind, which is so amazing that it can know itself fully, is someone who is emotionally so distant that you don't actually give a shit about anyone or anything in this stuff. And if you do want to read a novel about a mind which can approach knowing itself fully, which is still identifiable in a human way, just read Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keynes. It's like one of the best science fiction novels ever. Just read that one instead. Story number 3, Division by Zero, is... about 20 pages long. And this is a question of what happens if all of mathematics is based on an inconsistency. There's no logic at the basis of the logic of mathematics. And the answer is like, wouldn't this turn you a bit crazy? Wouldn't this drive a mathematician mad if they found out that maths didn't have... And so the setting is people in rooms thinking about stuff and coming up with an idea. The plot is someone working on the answer to a problem by sitting in a room and thinking about it a lot. The character... I think we're meant to think that there's a character development, but then there's like this non-linear storytelling, which means it's hard to relate to anyone as they go through these developments. You know, sometimes they're happy and then sad and then happy and then sad. And you're like, well, were they first happy and then sad, or are we just flipping the storyline around? So there's this thing and there's a conflict between different people. And it's like, I have this story arc, but which order do the bricks in this arch go? And if you just take the bricks in an arch and mix them around again and put them together again, does that make a satisfying character arc? I'm not really sure. So it didn't really connect to me on a character level. Thematically, I guess one of the main things is what happens if the basis of your profession is shown to be meaningless. Like maybe if robots take over your work and you don't have anything to do anymore, or technology renders what you do useless and you don't have any direction. I think that's what the story is talking about. I mean, it can't just be talking about what happens if maths is a lie, because it doesn't really matter. If the basis of maths is a lie, in the real world, it doesn't matter. It won't impact anybody's life. People talk about, oh, what if existence isn't real? What if it's all happening in my head? What if this? It's like, well, it doesn't really matter, because pragmatically, you're just going to go about it anyway. And I don't want to bring it all down to pragmatics, but maths is so devoid of emotional impact for me that it just didn't even make me think. And the characters were so sparsely written that I couldn't identify with these characters when something happened which was big enough to drive them crazy. It takes a novel for me to care about a character enough that when mathematics makes them go crazy, I care about them. You know, maybe it doesn't take a full novel, but that's the kind of thing. I'm sure I've read science fiction novels where somebody gains knowledge or suddenly their world is turned around by a revelation, but, you know, it takes time for me to care and things like that. There's just not space for the idea in this story. It left me frustrated. And I don't think the idea, it's either the idea is big enough, is too big for it in the story, or it's not big enough to fit even in the short story. Because you could just say, hey, just imagine that at the root of all mathematics, there's no meaning. It's actually logical. Any number can mean any other number. Wouldn't that drive someone crazy, a mathematician crazy? I'd go, yeah, maybe. That's what this story is. I just said it. Or give me a novel which has got enough character development in that case. Okay, Story of Your Life, which is the title story of Stories of Your Life and Others, which is actually a clever play on words for the story. In fact, the clever play on words for the story of this anthology, Stories of Your Life and Others, based on a story which is called Story of Your Life, but it also contains other stories, or maybe your life, or other life. Oh, forget it. I'm not even going to explain it. But, like, that. The clever play on words is better than this story. And I think this one, let me bring up this. I opened his Wikipedia page. Yeah, Story of Your Life won a Nebula Award. Not quite sure how, but it obviously affected lots of people. So, aliens think differently to us. Yeah, so that's the idea behind this. And the setting is people in rooms, and the people, and the plot is kind of someone working out the answer to a problem by sitting in a room and thinking about it a lot. Again, sometimes with other people and sometimes with a computer and bits of paper, but generally someone sitting in a room working stuff out. There's like the characters wise, there is a character, but like the only characters, they're just sitting around, like, sitting in rooms and working out answers. Now, there is this other character in there, which is the story of your life. It's written in kind of, these sections are written in, like, second person, talking to somebody, and these bits are, like, sprinkled through the story in a non-linear way. Now, this storytelling in a non-linear way, it does make a bit more sense in this story for plot reasons and thematic stuff, which I'm not going to go into right now, but it does make sense, but it doesn't just telling me about a character or having someone talking to a character doesn't really give them a character arc. You just go, oh, here is your story. Great. Okay, I know my story now. But it doesn't let me connect to people on a character level at all. And the main character is just somebody who is in the future going to become a mother. And that's all we really know about them. Oh, and they're a scientist. And there's a bit of a love story. But there's no real, like, when they work towards the goal and then they achieve their goal, it doesn't affect their life in any way, which is, again, the theme of the novel. I mean, sorry, the theme of the short story, but that's very unsatisfying. So that one of the main, technology, there is aliens and they look a bit different to us, right? And they arrive in orbit and then they leave and there's one bit of technology, but generally just an alien which look and think different to us. That's pretty much all we get there. So the main theme of the book is like the arrow of time and how it would affect the memories if the arrow of time went the other ones. And the whole kind of like, if you had new words to think with, how would that affect the way that you think? And how about if some of those new words were alien words, and what would Wittgenstein think of this kind of stuff? You know, all that kind of like how the words you use affect your memory. Great. All that kind of stuff. Except it's very unsatisfying in a short story because I don't have those words. And if you just tell me what these words are without me being able to, grok them? Actually, I think that's the whole point, is that I can't grok this because the human mind isn't big enough or able to look at words or use symbols or use modes of thought like they are in this book. But then when we do get someone who is presented, or when we are presented with someone who has been able to use these words and to think in the same way that the aliens are able to think, which is interesting, but not new compared to other novels that I've read about the same thing. When we get to that conclusion, it really just sounds like someone is like has Alzheimer's and they're just like a confused old person who isn't quite sure what's going on. And I was thinking, well, surely there must be more to it than this. Or maybe there isn't. Maybe this is what it is. Confused old people with Alzheimer's are actually thinking like aliens do. Is that the point of this stuff? So I was just thinking, ugh. Anyway, didn't really grab me on any level at all. It was just like saying, hey, what happens if your memories were like this? Or what happens if you perceived life in this way? You know, just say that. And I'd be like, oh, well, I guess something like this could, you'd think a bit like this. It'd end up like someone like with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's who can't remember stuff and all the memories are jumbled up and they can't remember where they are or what, you know, they have no footing in reality. Is that it? I mean, again, maybe I'm just missing all of this. It won a Nebula Award. Lots of people must have got something big out of this short story. It kind of passed me by in a way. So at this point, after reading four short stories in the overall novel, short story collection, I was really not enjoying the book very much at all. The first story was good, and then three stories in a row were about people sitting in rooms trying to work out solutions to problems, and then the answer breaking their brain in a way which kind of sent them mad, but made me just think, huh. And I was thinking, okay, I really do hope that the rest of these stories aren't going to be stories of people sitting in rooms trying to work out problems, and then when they discover the answer to the problem, it turns their brain a little bit mad. And thankfully, the next story was really, really good. Number 5, 72 Letters. This convinced me that there was really something to the concept of a short story as a form of itself. Well, I already know this, but like in this novel, it's not novel. I keep calling it a novel because I pick up a book and I think novel, it's a short story collection. Anyway, so the setting of 72 Letters is Victorian London, which is a great shortcut to an interesting setting. You can just say Victorian London and there's this person who comes from this kind of background and you're just like, I know all of this and it's interesting and it's not like the real world and it's timeless. You know, you set something in Victorian times, it's timeless. If you set something in generic now, that's what happened with these previous three short stories. Someone will say, oh, and it got onto a computer and did this, and I was like, wait a second, that's not how a computer works. Ah, maybe it is how a computer worked in 1992. And you're missing out, but if you get a consistent, self-consistent setting, which you can just use a shortcut, Victorian London, Victorian England, great, that's all I need to know. But also, it's more than that. He actually uses things called settings, like he writes about a room, and it's not just a person sitting in a room. I mean, people do sit in rooms and work things out, but these rooms are now in factories or in stately homes or in dark cellars or in a drawing room or in a tool shed or in a drawing, you know, all this different kind of places, you know, actual places where things happen, not just white rooms with white walls that people sit in and don't really care about. Now people are in and they're noticing their environment. And more importantly, the environments that they're in guides their actions. When he's in a tool shed, he does this kind of stuff. When he's in a drawing room, he acts in this way towards other people. When he's in a cellar, he can do this kind of stuff. And when he's in a stately home, he, like this. You know, it actually affects the action. It has some impact on there. So the setting was really good. Now, the technological idea in this is a little bit like in the same theme as the Tower of Babylon. And that is like, what if this pseudo-scientific or pre-scientific idea about life were true or about the universe were true? In this case, it's about life. So what happens if golems could actually be made, make something out of, make a figure out of clay and animate it with some kind of Kabbalic word. And what if sperm contains, not sperm, but like, let me put this, what if ejaculate doesn't contain sperms, but these little homunculuses, which then like go inside an egg and then grow up. So your human body is like fully formed and then just grows into its proportions, into its real size and proportions. Now, these two ideas are like really cool, really awesome. And they're both presented at the beginning of the book. So you're thinking, okay, by the end of it, these two concepts are going to come together. And actually, about halfway through, these two concepts do come together in a very, very satisfying way. And then there's a problem. Now, the problem is an answer. It is a scientific question. And there is a scientific question which has to be answered. However, unlike the previous stories, the question is no longer academic. It means something, and it's really important. You know, it's not just an important answer to the question, but getting the answer is very, very important. Like the Tower of Babel, it's like, what's up there? I don't know, let's have a look. Okay, and people see what's up there. You know, and the second story is like, what happens if I inject myself with this drug to make me really intelligent? I will. okay, this happens, great. And then what happens if this maths problem, blah, blah, blah? It's like, okay, I'll work it out. What happens? Well, nothing really outside of my own head. What happens, you know, if these totally passive and benign aliens, you know, like how do we communicate with these totally passive and benign aliens? Turns out nothing except inside of this one person's head. There's no urgency to any of these pursuits of knowledge. What's up there? What happens? What about this math problem? Passive aliens, how do we communicate? You know, in 72 Letters, the fifth story in this collection, it has jeopardy. You know, it's have like, okay, fucking hell, wait a second, there's something over here, there's this really big problem, if we don't sort it out, everything is gonna go fucking wrong, the world is gonna end. And then once that is established, there's another twist, like a conspiracy within a conspiracy, where there's real drama between different factions. You know, there's people going, ah, I want to solve the problem this way, no, I want to solve the problem this way, and there's other characters and other factions which don't really even know what's going on, but they're fighting against it, even not quite understanding what's going on. So there's real drama, there's real jeopardy, there's different people doing action, and there's actually action happening as well. People move around, they go here and there, they fight, they do stuff, they're building stuff, they're breaking stuff, they're, you know, quarreling, they're conspiracies and stuff. It's not just people sitting in a room talking about stuff. And there's characters as well. Now, the main character isn't very complex, but he's put into a position where his morals and ethics are challenged, and then he has to fight what he believes in. And at the end, when he solves the scientific problem, which is no surprise, because that's what these stories are about, when he solves the scientific problem, it validates his character. It validates his outlook. You know, he starts as a child at the very beginning of the book, playing around, and in the end, he becomes like the father to a whole new kind of humanity. That's not really a spoiler, because that's you find out what's going on right at the very beginning of the book. I mean, it's very obvious. It's like, oh, golems and life. What's going to happen? He's going to create a new form of life. And by the end of it, that's what they're aiming at. That's what everyone is aiming for by the end of the novel. And when he does it, like I say, it validates him as a character. It's a very sparse character. It's just a few little shortcuts. It's like he is noble and he is fighting against people who aren't. He is humanitarian and he's fighting against people who aren't. But it makes a lot for that. Which brings me to the themes. Which, like I say, the rest of these stories, at the end of the story or partway through the story, a discovery is made. And then we don't see how it plays out. Or the discovery is made and it's so minor that it only affects the brain of one character. And it's a character they don't even care about or know about. But 72 Letters, it stops in the same place at the discovery of this thing, at the discovery of this scientific principle, if you let me put it that way. But beforehand, we're told about the kind of impacts that would be possible to have on society, you know, and how they might happen. Some paths, like, okay, if we do this, that might happen. And if we do this, that might happen. And some paths, we want to take this path, we don't want to take this path. This path is good, this path isn't good. And there's all these different things. So at the end of the story, once we get that revelation, I don't have to read a longer story because I'm already given the possible outcome and futures of the society, and the main character chooses one of them. Which is important, because then it's wrapped up. It doesn't leave a question hanging, like, what will happen next? We're given, okay, these are the possible things that are going to happen next, and the main character chooses that one, and that's the reason for the story to exist, and that's the reason for the scientific discovery to be made and to be worked for and stuff like that. So it brings it together. There's lots and lots of other themes going on in this book, but suddenly they mean something to me because they can be applied to a society which exists and applied to characters which I care about using tools that were interesting in settings that were fascinating. So it's probably my favorite short story in the collection. But really, this really does break down into sort of like three short stories which I really didn't like, one story which I liked quite a bit, and then three stories which I really liked. And this was one of the stories which I really liked. I could probably do a full SFBRP episode just on this one short story, which I probably just have done, actually. But it's got that much substance. So number six isn't really a short story. It's called The Evolution of Human Sciences. It's about 3 pages long. And it's like this cute fake article about what humans will be getting up to after like post-human minds take over science. And it's fun, but it's just the kind of material, like, you know, if you're reading like an Alistair Reynolds novel, he would just like throw this in as kind of side material flavoring and things like that. And that's what it is here. It's sort of a little bit of, you know, flavoring. It's like, hey, check out this little one idea that I had. Isn't that cute? And you go, yeah, that is quite cute. And then you move on. Story number seven is Hell is the Absence of God. Again, this is one of the three stories which I thought was the best in the collection. Let me just check it out. It's around about, 30 pages long. And it's same kind of what if this pseudoscientific model of the world was real. And this time it is gods and angels and heaven and hell and the afterlife and demons and things like that. So starting off with the setting, let me get onto the setting in a bit, but let's start with the plot. So first of all, the plot is we're not sitting in a room with people just trying to find the answer to the problem, because the problem is known. The problem is, you know, what is your place in the world? What is your place in the afterlife? And what do you need to do to get into the afterlife? And the problem is known. And the problem is that God moves in mysterious ways and that we really don't know the mind of God. So how you get to heaven, or, you know, how you get, what sends you to hell, or how do you get to heaven, is not really well known. And there's people who are always trying and striving to find out the answer to this question. And there's other people who are just going, fuck it, I'll just go to hell when I finish. It's not too bad. It doesn't look too bad. And heaven seems like a bit too much hard work to get into. I'll just live a fulfilling life. You know, so there's this different kind of thing. But the plot is people trying to fathom out those ways of getting into heaven or avoiding hell and things like that by doing stuff. Sometimes they're sitting in a room talking with people. Sometimes they're in therapy sessions. But a lot of the time they're preaching and they're driving trucks and they're living in a desert and they're hunting angels and things like that. Also, with this plot, is that the answers to... there's not really an answer to a question, but the actions that the characters take, again, have a lot of weight. Like, how can you reunite with a dead wife? And you think you're going to hell, and she's in heaven, and it's really tricky. How do you get into heaven? That's a really difficult question. You know, and where is your eternal soul going? It's not abstract. In this world, those questions are abstract in a way, but they're concrete for the people who believe in them. In this world, everyone believes in God because they have statistics proving or showing how many people he's killed this month. And things like that. The characters, we don't just get one character, we get three characters. And the characters, they're not very complex. Again, they don't need to be contracts, but each one of the characters wants something. And they go out and try to find it, the answer to it, the solution to their problem. Whatever it is that they want, they are looking for the answer. And by the end of the story, some of them get their answer, some of them don't get their answer, some of them are more confused at the end of the story than they were at the beginning, but they go through these different phases. This is what's called a character arc, and it's missing from 4 of the 8 stories in this short story collection. Bring on to the setting. Now, the setting is the modern world, but added angels. There's angels and things that arrive. And he uses the shortcuts, like I said before. New York. Okay. Fifth Avenue in New York was visited by an angel. Now, it could be anywhere in New York. However, the glass fronts to the stores on Fifth Avenue in New York, it's the flying glass, which results from the angel turning up, is a plot point. That is needed for the plot. It needed to happen in a place where flying glass is happening for the plot to make sense. Again, this is not a spoiler or anything like this. It happens in like the first 2 pages of this 30-page short story, so I don't mind doing that. But the later locations mean something as well. Even the places where people meet to talk, the rooms that people meet to talk in, they don't meet in a church, they meet in a church basement. That means something. That difference between meeting in a church hall and a church basement means something in this book. And then there's the description of this angel blasted landscape, which was I found so interesting that I actually stopped and read it out loud for my girlfriend. I said, "Hey, this is really good." Actually, I'll read it out loud in a second. Let me just get a book, the book and a drink. I should be able to find this quite quickly because it's a short story. So once I find the short story, I should be able to find it. Here we go. So this is talking about a holy place, a holy site. And that's where angels normally turn up. Holy sites were invariably in inhospitable places. One was an atoll in the middle of the ocean, while another was in the mountains at an elevation of 20,000 feet. The one that Neil traveled to was in a desert, an expanse of cracked mud reaching miles in every direction. It was desolate, but was relatively accessible and thus popular among pilgrims. The appearance of the holy site was an object lesson in what happened when the celestial and terrestrial realms touched. The landscape was variously scarred by lava flows, gaping fissures, and impact craters. Vegetation was scarce and ephemeral, restricted to growing in the interval after soil was deposited by floodwaters or whirlwinds and before it was scoured away again. Pilgrims took up residence all over the site, forming temporary villages with their tents and campervans. They all made guesses as to what location would minimize their chances of would maximize their chances of seeing the angel while minimizing the risk of injury or death. A site-specific paramedic and fire department ensured that paths were kept clear so rescue vehicles could go where they were needed. So that kind of setting, that's like two paragraphs of setting, and suddenly all of the action or all of the every single moment that a character is in that location, we are thinking, holy shit, an angel could turn up and the world could be flipped upside down, a crater could open, a crack could open in the ground that could just fall through it, all of the like the fucking biblical stuff, the Old Testament, boom boom boom, God, angel, death, destruction, all of that kind of stuff is like wrapped up in two paragraphs, and that's all we need so that everything that takes place in that location from then on has more jeopardy, has more import. So I really like that kind of thing. Me just reading it to you sort of wraps up everything that I want to say, and it works on a thematic level as well, which is what I'm wanting to bring to here. And the theme is in this short story, or one of the themes is, of course, fucking hell, God is a cunt. Who could ever love a prick like God? And again, we're talking about Old Testament God here, so I don't want to just, say, if you believe in God, you believe in this God. This is kind of Old Testament kind of God going on here. But that's one of the themes that I got from this story. But there is many, many other themes in this story about faith and belief and love and meaning in life and meaning in death and all these other kind of stuff is wrapped up in this little 30-page short story. And it has an end. The story has an end. There's a scientific discovery at the end of it. Well, not really. No, there isn't. In fact, there isn't really a scientific discovery at the end of it. It's more of a statistical discovery at the end of it, because all of the answers are there in the statistics already for the characters, and they're just trying to understand their place in a world which is run by statistics, but God exists, but God is kind of runs by statistics as well, which is strange. And there is a twist. But again, the twist is more of a statistical fluke than it is a... there's a few statistical flukes at the end, which are more statistical flukes rather than answers to questions. Very, very satisfying place to end, because all the characters are either have their question answers, their journey is ended, or there's a whole other mystery put on top of their shoulders. But the point is that in this case, the mystery that's dumped on the shoulder is God works in mysterious ways. Oh, one of the reasons for it being a mystery, God is a cunt. Anyway, next up, story number eight, Liking What You See, a documentary. Hopefully I'll be able to finish this podcast in under an hour, but I have reviewed eight short stories here. So let me just remind myself. Oh yes, of course. This one is another really great shortcut into how to make a short story where you don't have to include setting or dialogue or all of these other things, but then don't let me feel cheated, or don't let your reader feel cheated that you're not including that. And that's pretend that you're reading a transcript of the spoken words in a documentary, and when he just says, this is a documentary, you've just got to fill in all of the talking heads yourself. And it's easy to picture the talking heads, because this book is about liking what you see. It's about beauty. It's about all of this. So he doesn't give descriptions of what a beautiful person looks like. He leaves it up to you. Ted Chiang is very clever with this. He leaves it up to you to picture what you think a beautiful person looks like, or what an ugly person looks like. Because that is the thing. There's a little quirky little technology thing here. You can get a brain manipulation operation called a Kali. Can't remember what that stands for, but I can remember it's called a Kali. And it means that you no longer see how good looking someone is, or how beautiful someone is, or how ugly someone is. You just see them as a person. So by him not describing what people look like, he makes you think, I'm going to give you a name. They're called this. They're a professor at a college. What do you think they look like? Do they look good looking? Do they look ugly? This is their role in the story. What are you going to... What face are you going to imagine in your mind when I tell you the name of this person and the position of this person or what their function is in this story? And that's really clever. This is a story which has no descriptive text at all, which is about what you picture in your mind when somebody doesn't describe someone to you. It's genius. I mean, you just, it might take you a while to get your head around that, but read the story. It's really clever. The setting, he just says, this is a documentary about something that takes place in an American college. And that's all he has to say. All of the rest of it, you just fill in your head what it's like with college here, and you get the different political factions and the different student groups and all that kind of stuff. It's all in there. But him just saying college, he doesn't have to describe anything else. He doesn't have to say anything else. He doesn't have to set out, okay, now there are things called professors and these are the students over here and here are the parents of the students. He just goes, parent of student, and then just goes with it at all. So the plot is that his brain manipulation thing, Callie, I said that already, but, you know, you can't tell if someone's beautiful or ugly, which means that your good looks or somebody else's good looks don't influence you in any way. It's their character, it's their being, it's their bearing, it's the attractiveness and the competence of them as a person rather than their good looks. And the student body wants, there's a vote, because some of the student body want all of the students to have the Cali, and so everyone is equal. And there's a vote at the end. I mean, they know that, you know, there's going to be a vote, and there's a vote at the end, and the vote either goes one way or the other, and there's a little bit of consequences, and then that's the end of the story. So the big question is, there's no discovery to make, there's no like new scientific, well, there's a little bit of new science that comes in partway through the story, but generally it's like, which way will the vote go, and why will the vote go one way or the other, and there's a little bit of a twist at the end, and then it finishes. But you got to the end of the story, and it brings up new questions, which are interesting, but it resolves the story. And the characters in the story, their lives will be affected in the outcome of this vote, one way or the other. And that's interesting. Now, of all the characters in this novel, it's really strange that there's a character in this one. I can't remember her name. Let me just look up a name, because I should be able to find it. It's the last story here. Her name is Tamira Lyons. And for me, she has the clearest and best character of any of the characters in this short story collection. She's had the Cali her whole life, and then she goes to college and she has this turned off, and she isn't sure. I mean, she discovers what it's like to be either good looking or not good looking. She doesn't even know if she's good looking or not. And then she discovered what it's like to see beautiful people for the first time. For the first time in her life, she's actually seeing the world and other human beings in a way that a human can see. Not only that, but she uses the technology in the story to work towards a very concrete goal, which is character-based. And you see the development of her character over the time. And all she's doing is like, she's just talking to a camera. She's saying, oh, I did this and I thought this and I really wanted to do this, but I'm not really sure what I'm feeling about. So it's just like a teenage girl telling her story in these very short paragraphs. But in these short paragraphs is more character than most of others, because, you know, it's actually a real person and we're going through what she's going through and finding out what she thinks and seeing the consequences on the wider world and the consequences of the wider world and society on how she thinks and how she is developing, going from a child to an adult, and also from an innocent being into a naive being who doesn't even know what beauty is into a character who does, and things like that. So we got lots of themes in this as well. Self-image and prejudice, and again, too many themes to mention because it's a really good short story. And that's what I like with a good short story. You know, use the tricks to keep it short. Use the shortcuts to keep it short, but have real people trying to achieve real goals that mean something. That means something to them, importantly, rather than just something in their brain. Oh, they discovered something and their brain broke. Fucking wow. I don't give a shit. People's brains break all the time. Unless you, and this is what's good, if you're a good enough author, you can make my brain break. And some authors do make my brain break. And I think, wow, now I'm looking at the world in a different way than before. And in some of these short stories, Ted Chiang probably would be able to do that, people. I don't think any of these really do grab it to me enough, because they're kind of common themes which I've read about a lot and have thought about a lot in the past. But this last one, this, what was it called again? Picturing, liking what you see, a documentary. This is one of the, this is, I think, the only story in here which really made me look at fiction or what fiction can do in a new way, or make me look at my own ideas in a new way. Even though it's like well-trodden ground, he did kind of break my brain in a bit. He didn't tell me that somebody else's brain had broken. He actually changed my own brain. And novels can do that quite a lot. Short stories can only do it in very few times. So let me just quickly pop across here to Wikipedia, and I'll look at Ted Chiang's page and make sure I didn't miss anything out here. I've not read... let me see what other... Oh, yeah. Merchant of the Alchemist Gate, you can get that for free, actually. And Exhalation, both of them, you can find them as readings on podcasts, so you can read those two. Exhalation is more of a man sitting in a room working out a discovery and then some stuff happening. Not very interesting. For me, I didn't find it very interesting at all. It's more of a division by zero, understand or story of your life kind of story. Whereas The Merchant and the Alchemist Gate, for me, is much more of a 72 letters, hell is the absence of God and what's expected of us. Oh, no, liking what you see, what's expected of us? Oh, it's another nature short thing as well. And then The Life Cycle of Software Objects, I think that's the only short story of his that I've not read. Oh, and there's Darcy's Patent Automatic Nanny. Not read that either. I would say, judging by this list, from 1990 up to 2007, Ted Chiang really improving a lot as an author. Tower of Babylon is a good start. A real step back with Division by Zero and Understand and Story of Your Life. But then with 72 Letters, Hell of Us the Absence of God, and Liking What You See, a documentary, those three stories are really good, as is The Merchants of Alchemist Gate. So if you're only going to read four short stories, I would go with those four. 72 Letters, Hell is the Absence of God, Liking What You See, a Documentary, and The Merchants of Alchemist Gate. And the rest of them, Tower of Babylon's cute, and Exhalation is cute as well, but Story of Your Life? I wouldn't have named my short story collection after that one. Anyway, what else do we have here? No, I'm at the end of my notes. Let me just check. Yeah, that's it. You can follow me on goodreads.com. Oh, I would give a rating to this, but it's really tricky. I put 4 stars on goodreads.com, which is what I was getting to now. Goodreads.com, you can follow me there. Luke Burridge. Follow my reviews, see what I'm up to. And I also, when I finish a book, I can click on the Goodreads page thing and see what you guys think about the book. Let me just do that quickly. Oh, no, this podcast is going long again. But I can probably do this. Story of Your Life and Others. Oh, I gave it 3 stars here. Some of the stories, as short stories, I would give 5 stars, but then there was 3 short stories in a row, which really brought this down for me, which is a real pity, because if those 3 short stories hadn't been in a row, if they'd been spread out among the others, I'd have probably enjoyed this short story collection a lot, but there was a big chunk in the middle where I was just going, I can't deal with this anymore. But yeah, pretty much everyone gives this short story collection 4 and 5 stars. It seems to be very well read and reviewed. 38 friends on goodreads.com give it 4.52 stars on average, probably the highest rated book that I've seen here among listeners to the SFBRP. So that's it for me. You can email me, luke@juggler.net, if you want to disagree, or if you want to agree with anything, or agree or disagree, or just give any kind of feedback. luke@juggler.net is the best way to get in hold of me. Follow me on goodreads.com. You can find me there. I'm on Twitter at Luke Burridge there. Check out my blog and my own fiction on my website as well, lukeburridge.com. That's it for now. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.